Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is Gary Revel. He tells the story of his life in his new book, To Live or Maybe Not. From service in the US Navy to his work for the US government to his investigations into the deaths of JFK, his brother Bobby, and Martin Luther King Jr. The book ends with his family back in Hollywood, where he returns to his passion for music and writing. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be with you today.
Oh, I'm happy to have you with us today. Thank you for joining us. So tell me why you decided to write this book. How did you know you had a story to tell?
It happened in 2006 as I was on the internet and I was Googling some things that I had done. And I found a book that was published by the United States Government Printing Office called Investigation of the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. And when I began to read it, I realized that it was the transcripts from the tape recordings I made of my interviews with James Earl Ray at Brushy Mountain Prison and the interviews that I helped set up and record for the House Assassinations Committee. So at that point, I remembered that the chief counsel, Richard Sprague, who I met and commissioned me in the beginning of that effort in early 1977, had promised me that my name would never be released. I was a special covert special investigator, and it was up to me to decide if I ever released my name as far as being associated with investigating those assassinations. And I realized that he had not been faithful or he had not been able to be faithful to his promise to me. So I decided then, well, I've got to write my story, you know, in my own book and publish it myself so that if anybody is interested, they can actually discover the facts of this whole matter.
Yeah, fascinating. So how did you come to interview James Earl Ray and what did you learn from that?
Well, I was working with an attorney named Jack Kershaw in Nashville, Tennessee. I had done some investigations for him before, and he became the attorney for James Earl Ray and came to me one day in the office and asked me to investigate the matter. I didn't jump at it right away. It sounded like some dangerous work because I'd done stuff similar to that before for the government. So I waited, and then at a church service one night, a preacher came to me after the service and said, "God said to tell you to quit playing around in the shallow water and get on out there where it's deep." Well, I knew that God was telling me to go ahead and investigate the King assassination. Nobody else would have got that from that because that's what I was at that moment trying to decide. And I'd never gotten a word like that from anyone saying it was from God. So, to me, it was just a clear sign. Okay, God wants you to do this. So that's when I decided to do it. And then to do that, I told Jack, I said, well, I'll do it, but I have to meet James Earl Ray first. Because I had learned from my investigative work before that I could talk to a man for 5 or 10 minutes and pretty much find out whether he was a murderer or not. If he was, had the capacity to actually kill someone in cold blood. So I had to meet James and sit down with him and talk with him and find out what kind of person he really was. So that's how it started.
Wow. Interesting. And what kind of person did you feel like he was?
Well, the first meeting we had, I explained to him what I was doing and my experience in the military and stuff. And then he told me about his work as an MP in the Army and how he knew about how that worked, the need to know, and you only know what you have to know to do a job and that sort of thing. So we hit it off pretty good. And I let him tell his story. I said, just tell me the truth. I just want to know the truth of what happened. And if you did it, you did it. Fine. I'll work with that. And if you didn't, I'll work with that. So by the time he had finished about 3 hours, of talk there between the two of us, I did come to the conclusion that he probably did not do it, but still I had to investigate the matter myself for sure. But yeah, that's where it started. I came out of that meeting having a little doubt as to his actual guilt.
Wow, that's fascinating. So just kind of go back and explain why, I mean, if you can, why he was convicted for assassinating Martin Luther King then, and how all that kind of unfolded.
Okay, well, he was when he was arrested in London, he was brought back to the United States and put in a jail cell that was he was surveilled by camera and audio 24 hours a day. He never had a moment of privacy from that time on during his stay at the Memphis jail. And then he was threatened by his attorney. His attorney told him, if you don't sign this stipulation that says you're guilty, he said, we're going to try you and put you in the electric chair. You're going to die. And also, we're going to arrest your brother, put him in prison, and we're going to arrest your father. Whoa. And put him back in prison, because his father was like in his 60s or 70s, and he had escaped from prison from a real serious crime, but he had escaped from prison, and they had just left him alone because he kept clean. He didn't get into trouble. He was living a good life and contributing to society, so they didn't bother him. They left him alone, but they told Ray, they said, we're going to arrest him, put him back in prison if you don't, you know, sign this stipulation saying you're guilty. Well, that's what James, you know, Jim, well, I got to where I called him Jimmy. That's what Jimmy told me. He said, that's the only reason I signed it. It was really out of concern for my family more than anything else, and my dad. He said, but when I got in the trial, I didn't really say that I was guilty. He said, when they asked me for my plea, I said, well, I was guilty. You know, basically he was saying I was guilty for being involved with these people. He was associated with them, but he didn't do it. And when he tried to say that in court and object, you know, stood up and confronted the judge about it, said, no, I don't agree with the prosecutor. His attorney just shoved him down back into his seat and just said, no, just let's just go on. And they just convicted him and sent him to 99 years in prison. And you know what? He never had a trial. To this day, he never had a trial. And if he had had a trial, they couldn't have convicted him because the gun that he supposedly used to kill King, we've never been able to match it to the bullet. It's not the gun that the bullet came out of. So, yeah, that's why they would never give him a trial, because they couldn't have proved he was guilty anyway.
Yeah. So what does he or you believe was the reason for him being convicted? Who is trying to cover up what?
Well, Martin Luther King was, as far as J. Edgar Hoover was concerned, as far as Lyndon Johnson was concerned, he was a danger to our society. He was a troublemaker. He would go places and do marches and stir up people, you know, for civil rights. And they just hated him. So the white Southerners hated the man, you know, terribly. They wanted him dead. And then when he took a stand against the Vietnam War at the Riverside Church in New York on April 4th, 1967, I believe that was the final straw for those who wanted him dead. Well, they say, you know, now he's trying to, you know, stop the war. And the mafia, the mafia was very interested in that war because they made Drug Enforcement Association told me back then in 77 that they had made over $30 billion a year in profits in direct income from that heroin pipeline that brought the heroin down the Mekong River and through the Mekong Delta area and through the Southeast China Seas there to the United States and to other ports in the world. So the mafia didn't want the war to end.
Yeah.
You know, it was like taking food off their table. So when Martin Luther King took that step, you know, to start trying to stop that war, I think that was the final straw that got the right people together that had the power to do it and cover it up to finally decide, okay, we got to take him out.
Oh, is it? I mean, how much has this kind of point of view been publicized? Are a lot of people kind of on this point of view, do you think?
Well, not really, because I mean, there's so many people. See, the difference between me and the other authors that you can read about this, you know, the assassinations from, is I actually investigated the case myself. So my story is firsthand. I'm the real thing, basically. Whereas other people, they research and then they write books, you know, based on their research. And some of them do a little investigation, but not, you know, immersed in it like I was for a year. So they will come up with all kind of theories. I don't really have a theory. I just say, you know, I investigate it and here's what I found. I just report the fact that I found. But these people that have these theories, some of them, you know, I want them to continue to do that, because when things are hidden, they need to be, you know, talked about. So I'm glad they do it. But the theories don't really nail it down the way it absolutely is. The facts are, you know, definitely like John Kennedy. He was definitely killed because he would not end. He was going to end the Vietnam War. He had just wrote the National Security Council that he was going to end the Vietnam War, and that was his last straw, you know.
Yeah.
And then Martin Luther King, he jumped on that bandwagon. They killed him. And then Robert Kennedy, if he had became president, he said he was going to end the Vietnam War and he was going to go after his brother's killers. So they had to kill him too, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like a domino thing, you know?
Yeah. It's scary, isn't it, how history can be written by powerful people so it becomes fact. You know, if you look up who killed John F. Kennedy or who killed Martin Luther King, you know, the names are there of these people that we grow up learning about. It was James Earl Ray, you know, that's the answer to the question, and that just becomes fact over the years. But it's only for people like you that look into these so-called facts and find out that they're not necessarily true. And it's a scary thought, isn't it, really?
It is. Yeah, it is very interesting, you know, to realize that the facts that we read in our history books are not always true. Yeah, and it is. But you know, they have, you know, these organizations, these powerful agencies, government agencies, they have people, you know, in the newspaper offices, in the TV, you know, news places. They have them planted, you know, in these places to make sure things that they want to keep covered up are kept covered up.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. So how did you kind of turn this book, when you're talking so much about Martin Luther King and your time spent with James Earl Ray, into a book about you? Because there's a lot of you and your life and your family in this book too.
Well, when I started writing it, like I said, it was in 2006, and I've just finished this last edition just a couple of months ago. It's a 28th edition, so I've been working on it for a long time. But yeah, because I had to, in my mind, I thought, well, they won't, you know, why would they believe you and think you're telling the truth if they don't really know you, you know? So I decided just to write my story, you know, from my birth on, and then put the King assassination in it so they could see how it fits in context with my whole life.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. And tell us about your time in, you were serving in the Vietnam War yourself.
Well, that's a very interesting story as well. Because when I joined, my congressman had met with me and had me take a test to get appointed to the Naval Academy, but I wouldn't wait. I went ahead and joined as an enlisted man because I had two brothers serving in Vietnam at the time, and I wanted to join them. But at boot camp, the personnel officer had me come to the office and told me that my congressman had called and written a letter and told me he wanted me in an officer program. So right away, I got into the deep, dark world of covert operations with naval intelligence and the DIA and stuff like that, because my congressman had told the personnel officer that the test that I took to join the Naval Academy, the score was higher than any, you know, I'd made higher on the score on the test than anyone he had ever given the test to. So they saw something in me that was that they could use for government purposes, and they did.
Wow. So what did you do then?
I did some very deep, dark, and dangerous stuff that most of it I can't even talk about it today. I get warned from the president on down to my local congressman to keep my mouth shut, basically. But I did covert work. I did drug interventions. I did counter espionage work. I went on a mission that I can't even touch on into Vietnam itself, other than to say that. And I was shot. I was Mickey'd. One guy, a doctor, Mickey'd me, tried to kill me that way because we were investigating him. He was a doctor at the Naval Hospital in San Diego, and we knew he was moving narcotic drugs, you know, medicines, out of storage there at the hospital into the black market. He was making money off of selling these pain relief, you know, narcotic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was interesting, but, you know, I mean, it was the kind of stuff I liked to do, you know.
So it's stuff that when you look back on it, it's stuff that you're proud of. It's not things that you regret then.
I am proud of it to a certain extent. Of course, I'm not really proud of some of the things that you have to do in the process of doing that work, because sometimes people get killed and you don't really mean for them to get killed. But when you're in a gunfight, you know, what do? You just let them kill you, you know? So I would rather not to have had to kill people, but it was only, you know, I wasn't that kind of person that I would kill them, you know.
You have to do what you have to do.
Right. Yeah, I only did what I had to do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's an amazing, amazing story, your life. Tell us about the title, To Live or Maybe Not.
Well, that's very important to the whole story, because when I started writing my story, I said, well, what you're going to say in this book may get you killed. So I wrote it with the attitude, well, I may live or I might not, you know, when I put this out. So that's the way that worked.
Oh, wow. Well, I hope you continue to live. That would be nice. And what do your family think of you writing this book then?
Well, they kind of, you know, they suffered. My whole family suffered a lot because of my work. I mean, my brother was killed. He was 19 years old. He was killed right during my investigation of the assassination.
Oh, gosh, that's terrible.
Yeah, so they've all suffered, but they, you know, they just know. And they're happy to see me, you know, get this out now and really start talking about it, because I wouldn't talk about it for you know, a lot, 20, at least 20, 30 years. I would rarely even mention it, any of this work that I did, because it was just too dangerous.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's been a great honor to have you with us on the show. Gary Revel, thank you so much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of your book, it's called To Live or Maybe Not, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. Gary, thank you very much for telling us a part of your amazing story.
Thank you, Hannah. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks, Gary. Me too.